Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. Analytics topics covered conversationally and sometimes with explicit language.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 226. You know, psychologist Daniel Berline, I don't know if that's the right pronunciation, but that's what I'm going to use. He's known for developing a term called epistemic curiosity. It's what he described as a drive aimed not only at obtaining access to information bearing stimulation capable of dispelling uncertainties of the moment, but also at acquiring knowledge. It is a predominantly human characteristic. And in the world of analytics, it's kind of an extremely valuable aspect of what makes an analyst truly exceptional. And if it is so valuable, well, how do we maximize its growth in ourselves and in the analytics teams we might be leading? All right, let me introduce my co-host, Julie Hoyer. Hello, how are you?
Hello. I am good. Excited to be here.
Are you curious about this topic?
So curious. I can't wait.
I love it. And Tim Wilson, my other co-host, I know you're curious. How you doing?
How you going? I'm curious about your greeting. Yeah.
Thanks for that. Homage. And I'm Michael Helbling. We wanted to bring in a guest to join our discussion because we like it a lot. Mary Beth Maskevis is the founder of Insight Lime Analytics. She's also held marketing analytics roles at Kayak, eCapacity, and Amadeus Consulting. She's also an author, has a book about the end of the world called The World Silently Spinning. But today she is our guest. Welcome to the show, Mary Beth.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
I am excited to have you as well, and I'm super excited about this topic because it's one very close to all of our hearts, because probably all of us came up as analysts, and this aspect of both our intelligence and personalities was probably at the forefront of what made us really great at our jobs. But I think today, even just talking about that aspect, how do we build that in others as well as develop it in ourselves? When did you first, maybe a good way to kick this off, Mary Beth, is when did you first notice this was something that was really an element of making an analyst successful?
I mean, I think the moment that I started to train others was really when that started to click for me, which was, you know, what the company that Kayak bought called Momondo, and I first started to even have like an intern underneath me. I realized that it was way harder than I thought to teach somebody else, for one, and that curiosity was this like key component to doing some of the types of analysis that I was doing, that I realized that was sometimes different than some of the prescriptive stuff that was going around. I was really tied into the business itself, and it was something that wasn't just something that you could explain to someone in a few minutes and just have them get it. It was a really ongoing process. So I think it was pretty early on, you know, when I started to have other people around me, that I realized quickly that this was like a whole thing that was kind of tangible and kind of intangible at the same time, of like, oh man, like it's way more complicated to be a curious analyst and find the right things than you'd think.
Is it, I mean, where did you land on, is it teachable? Like, I feel like that's the big, big open question of how much of it, how much do you have to have some innate curiosity? Because I definitely feel like I've worked with people who just don't, and I just want to punch a wall because I cannot, we're not speaking the same language when I'm trying to help them figure out that that's what they should be doing.
Yeah. You know, when the topic came up and that kind of question came around, I chewed on it for like the last few days. And what I came up with is that willingness is even more important than curiosity, but there has to be some element of curiosity, because there could be someone who isn't necessarily like super innately curious, has some little spark, but is super willing to go there and try something new. And they could still be a good analyst. But if they're not willing, it's just not going to work. And I think any sort of science, data, et cetera, field, there has to be some aspect of curiosity, but like it can be something that someone flexes up. So that's really where I landed.
Yeah, that curiosity spark that you talked about too, I feel like closely ties to somebody's willingness to like step up and take on more or own something too. Because if you have someone that is not naturally curious and not, even willing, to your point, to do like the hard work or dig through things or go try stuff on their own, you end up with someone that has to be kind of like given a very clear task, and it starts to weigh down on the team. And so I loved when you brought up the curious and like the business context and the willingness, and like it's words I haven't necessarily used to describe when you recognize that spark in a young analyst and you're like, oh, they're going to get it. They're going to dig in and they're going to go places.
So on kind of, let's take the curiosity and willingness and maybe kind of like adding to that a little bit. Like, I feel like what can happen is that if an analyst is coming in and they're learning, this is the job, the business asks a question and you answer it, it's so easy to like stop. And on kind of two fronts, they ask how much traffic came to the site and I can answer that. And I need to be thinking, what is it they really, I need to be curious about what the underlying question they have is. But there's another piece of, I want to be sort of curious of saying, well, I can answer that question, but let me look at like where the traffic came from and maybe also what the traffic did. Because if I just give them that one answer, I may be missing something bigger. Like, and both of those are, it's kind of like, it's more work. Like you could say, I've answered the question, I can now move on to the next task. And you really, it does seem like you have to have some internal drive that says, but I'm not going to be satisfied. If I just answer that, I can check off the satisfaction of a task completed, but I'm not actually checking off this, like, I wonder why they wanted to know that. And I wonder what else was going on. And I wonder if I could surprise them and me with something else that's useful. Does that resonate?
Oh yeah. And I think that some analysts just fall into that pattern and end up being like order takers. It's really not as fulfilling as a role as I would think, or as useful. So that really resonates. I think there needs to be that internal drive. I think this other part of it is also like the internal drive to, even though analytical people generally have some certain personality types, like be willing to like ask those questions to somebody who's like probably more senior than you and doesn't really like think or act like you, and just like dig into that and be willing to have what might be sometimes kind of like an awkward conversation about it as well.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side too, you know, someone naturally having that demeanor and that disposition, do you ever run into, or like when you're advising your clients around data coaching or your training analyst, you know, that work for you, do you find that some of it is up to you or the organization to set those expectations for their analysts coming in? Just because I find, like, I'm thinking back to when I was a new analyst, I barely knew what my job was. And yeah, I was going to do what I was told. And it's like the whole world you don't know exists at first. And so I do wonder if a big piece of it is like setting that up front and communicating, hey, we want you to push yourself outside of the black and white box of like a determined task or something.
Yeah. And if you, I don't know if any of you or anyone listening has ever like looked at job descriptions for entry level analysts, they almost always are that very in the box. I just want you to pull reporting. It's really not even like looking at those sorts of skills or curiosity. So I do think it is partly on organizations to realize, and maybe that's like a data literacy thing as well, that data isn't just about like vomiting reports out as one of the terms, or like a data puke. It's really like broader than that, and true value of data analysis is something more. And so, yeah, I do think that there's some aspects where, and maybe that's part of my responsibility, is when I'm having some of my clients write job descriptions for roles, to remind them that there's some other skills and soft skills. I don't really like that term, but you know, non-technical skills that they should be looking for and expectations they should be setting beyond just the reporting.
But how do they look for it? I mean, I feel like it's like effective communication skills is like, mm-hmm. and it's like needs to have curiosity. Like, how do you, what are the questions, or what do you probe for to figure that out in an interview or non-interview, but some sort of recruitment situation?
I can tell you what we do and like what's worked really well for us. I don't think it's the only way, but what we do is a style of interviewing called behavioral interviewing, where instead of asking someone a question like, are you curious, or do you think you'd be curious in this job? Which, like, you know, not knocking on traditional interview questions, but it really can open up the opportunity for someone who's really suave to just explain their way out of almost anything. And what behavioral interviewing instead would do is ask a very specific question about an instance in the past. So you'd say, tell me about a time where your effort to be curious brought on a different result than what was originally expected of you, or something like that. And you push for that really specific answer. So if someone is answering in generalities, you can be like, can you give me a specific example? And you keep asking questions like that. It's been really effective because past performance indicates future performance, and the language that they would choose when answering a question like that is going to show whether curiosity is something where they are strong or not. Like, if you think about that specific question, it was kind of a big chunky one, but someone who was a curious person would probably light up and immediately have an example. So that's one of the ways that we've found to be really effective, and it's difficult otherwise to get that curiosity out of, like, a standard interview question.
Yeah, I've also found that the way that people interrogate a problem or a question can sort of do that. So in interviewing, I always use a very open-ended problem to gauge how the analyst will look at it and how they'll, because the value of the analysis is a lot of times determined by the question. And so a lot of times that can show, like, the other thing that you mentioned, Mary Beth, that I think really rings true to me too, is this idea of a willingness or an excitement to explore that just comes naturally to people. Like, when you throw somebody a problem and they really are just like, why are you making me answer this question? Like, what's going on here? Versus like, okay, let me think about this. And they sort of get into the game with you a little bit, because there's no right answer. It's a problem that just sort of has, like, any number of random outcomes. And it's just more about how do you think about it. And that's interesting because, you know, there's aspects of personality that sort of dictate curiosity, but not totally. And so, like, that's kind of what I feel like in an interview you can maybe identify as, like, someone with a natural inclination. Yeah, I like that a lot, well, what you said.
I mean, a long time, like, behavioral interviewing and most of the companies I've worked at for the last 15 years have, like, that's how they train their – so it's – I'm a fan of it. I always wonder, like, if you – it's crazy how often there are candidates who just haven't been coached that a behavioral interview, you should recognize it. You need an example. You need to be specific. Mm-hmm. You need to talk through the what you did. You need to talk through it. I'm sometimes shocked how candidates, like, don't seem to know they're being asked a behavioral interview question, and you're just, like – basically trying to get them to, like, no, I mean, it's specific. I'm never sure if they can't get specific. Is that because they're not processing that they need a specific example, or they don't have one? Like, or maybe it's a type one versus type two error. Like, if somebody crushes it and you ask a question, like, tell me about time that something, it's not what you were looking for, but you stumbled across it anyway, and they light up and they're just talking and talking and talking, and you're like, okay, I'm confident you check that curiosity box. If they don't, if they struggle, they seem like they're not understanding it, and maybe I just need to get more comfortable saying, well, the evidence I have, you didn't get drawn to that. You didn't light up on that, and maybe I don't need to give you the benefit of the doubt, I think. I don't know. Sorry, that took us back a little bit, Michael, from your problem question. But
no, I mean, I can comment to it a little bit. And I mean, I think this is nothing original to me. I'm using a methodology from a business coach, but what she's always saying is that if someone's not specific or something doesn't sit quite right with you, it's always where you should dig deeper when you're behavioral interviewing. So especially if it's something where, like, one question they really light up and they're super specific, and then you ask them something else that's, like, somewhere where you have an intuition that they may have a weakness and they answer in a generality, it's a really good opportunity to ask more questions in the same vein. So, like, asking just, like, for other different examples. And at least for me, I think that it's been a pretty good move of, like, looking at that really objectively afterwards and saying, like, this person just didn't want to go there to certain areas.
I gave them
like
every opportunity. Yeah. If they didn't get there, I'm going to have to draw the conclusion. I like that.
All right, it's time to step away from the show for a quick word about Pivot Pro. Tim, tell us about it.
Well, Pivot Pro is easy to implement, easy to use, and reminiscent of Google's Universal Analytics in a lot of ways.
I love that it's got basic data views for less technical users, but it keeps advanced features like segmentation, custom reporting, and calculated metrics for power users.
We're running Pivot Pro's free plan on the podcast website, but they also have a paid plan that adds scale and some additional features.
That's right. So head over to pivot.pro and check them out for yourself. Get started with their free plan. That's pivot.pro. All right, let's get back to the show.
So, but what happens if you're not in charge or you don't have the power to hire the people? Like, what if you get tossed some new analysts and they say, train them?
Yep.
And you start working with them and you're realizing maybe they aren't the most curious, or you have to figure out how curious are they? Like, do you have any tips for... you're with the person, they've been chosen for you. How do you determine the level they have? And then what are some things you can do to, like, if they're going to have the capacity to be curious, how can you help them grow that?
I love that there are a bunch of analysts at Search Discovery listening to this saying, Julie's talking about someone.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I've definitely inherited analysts before. And there, you know, there's a line, right? Like, there are some people I think that, you know, maybe aren't suited to their role and really aren't willing, right? And so they kind of go into one category, but let's talk about people who are to some degree and do want to succeed in their role. And I think it's kind of a journey. And one of the things that's been effective for me has been leading by example. And it just takes time, but showing them some other ways to do things and showing them that it brings more energy to the organization. So starting off with one analysis where I lead it and bring them in on that whole process, like letting them listen to the executive talk about the business problem and everything, and then start asking them some of those questions that really drive curiosity. So like they bring me something and I say, okay, well, you know, traffic was down on this site, so what? And usually the first time you ask them a so what, they panic. But like after a while, they realize that it's not like a rude so what. It's like, what does that mean? Is this something that I really should bring to the executive? And it usually takes a few times before that really starts to like digest for them. But that's one of the things where they just need to see the value that they're driving, I think. And my, you know, for my team now, they're so focused on that, that if they don't feel like they're driving value, they're like, ah, I don't feel like working for this client anymore. So I've got them a little addicted to it, but.
Yeah. Addicted to impact. That's awesome. Yeah.
But that's along the lines of the, okay, Ricky Messick is the guy who introduced this to me, the like how to transition, how to teach somebody. And he was quoting something else and I cannot, it's like, I do, you watch, we talk, I show, it's like five steps or something,
yeah,
but then it's like,
steps.
You do, I watch, we talk. It's like, it's a progression and it sounds like it's that, cause it does, you need to have that part of the end to say, I mean, I feel like I've run into this time at times where somebody has, even if we're kind of doing it together, at the end of it, they walk away and say, I don't know, you just like found that thing. And it's like, well, that's not helpful. It's not helpful to be just perceived as like, oh, well, there's some amorphous thing that that person had that I don't have. It has to be brought back down to let's deconstruct it a little bit. And if we asking so what seems like a really useful way, it seems like there might be other ones that are, you know, but why, or, you know, what else? I don't know how, I have not done this. I do not have this figured out, but that's where my head kind of went.
Yeah. I think it, you know, what you're getting to is like the other thing I think of like how to bring a team along that maybe hasn't been as used to that type of investigation and curiosity is just like training. And there's different training methodologies of how to like get to an insight or explore data that they're not really teaching in school. They don't really teach them, you know, teach people to like explore data sets before or like kind of inquire and just kind of think about the broader business context and such when they're looking at a data set. It's very, you know, more laser focused of you're going to cleanse this data set and then you're going to run this regression, blah, blah, blah. And so doing actual structured trainings on what I call like investigative analysis is something that helps because it's just not trained that way. And so then it just gives them a new tool set of like, well, how on earth did Mary Beth get to that conclusion, or how did she find that spike of traffic at this one time and show that it was this thing? It's like, it's not magic and it's not like a skill that I have that other people don't. It's just a difference in like how you're analyzing.
What is that investigative analysis structure? I mean, I feel like this whole discussion is around like this really hard thing to sort of quantify and nail down. And as soon as you try to put structure to it, there becomes this idea that, oh, run them through an hour of training, give them the checklist, and now they figured it out, which it requires. Like, so how do you talk about or frame the investigative analysis piece of it so that it can be taught and applied and learned and refined?
Yeah, I'll talk through the process, but I'll say that usually the process goes, I do the few hours of training, everyone goes and doesn't get any of it, and I terrorize them for a few months, and eventually some of the pieces start to click. So it's not a beautiful, perfect, come by my magical process today kind of thing. But the example I'm going to give and the way we do it is super, super specific to like digital analytics. So grain of salt with that. It's different for some other fields, but all like digital analytics, like e-commerce metrics, they're like all a summation of each other. So like one thing I start with talking about is like, if you're looking at conversion rate is the sessions and the purchases. So if you see a movement in conversion rate, what should you go look at? You should go look at, did the traffic go up or down? Did the amount of purchases go up or down? Where, and if they did go down, where was the drop off in that funnel? So it's like starting to map, and we make little maps for them and have them map it out of like, if you're going to look at conversion rate, what are all the possible things that contributed to a conversion rate going down? So that's like one of the tactical pieces of it. It also gives them a really strong understanding of the structures of that data so that they do know how to look through it. And then it's also like doing some other examples of the other business context in there. I usually try and trick them once or twice with something like bot traffic or something like that, where there's a huge spike and they'll come to me and say, wow, there was, you know, this big spike of traffic, and they like say, oh, and this thing happened. And then I can be like, okay, well, here's five layers deeper of like, if you looked at the country and the bounce rate of that traffic, you can see now that actually it was most likely bot traffic or something like that. And they go, oh man. And like some of those contexts like that. So we do it. It's like I said, super specific to like website analytics data, but that's one of the ways is this like kind of like logic map of like, I see this number go up or down. Where do I look to figure out what that means or if it means anything? And so that's one part of it. It's not just that.
So there's a deconstruction.
Yeah, there is a deconstruction. So there is kind of a formula. And then I think it's also like training the way of thinking. Like it is training the curiosity because it's like, I see something like that. I'm going to want to verify it. So just like starting to be like, if you see this, then you do this. And like another way we started to do that was having our team do what we call as data watchdog procedures for clients, especially during like peak periods, where I have them look every single day at the traffic, which usually I'm not a fan of daily, but, and then I actually continue to validate with them because they'll be like, oh, the traffic was up and it meant this. And I can be like, did it really mean anything? Or when you compare it to a larger aggregate, it doesn't mean anything. And it just gives them the opportunity to like repeatedly do that. And it's no like, oh, you're just looking at these five numbers and telling me if they go up and down. It's like what happened as a whole. So those are like a few methods. But like I said, I haven't found the perfect formula, but that's been really helpful. And I think it takes about like we've expanded this out because we've been like, well, how long does it take before someone can graduate to be like a full analytics consultant? And we think it takes at least 3 years. At first we had a different, it's a long time. So
I'd say 3 to 4 years is my experience to be a truly great, to be truly like on your own analyst. Yeah.
I really do think it is the building blocks that you laid out, Mary Beth, of just getting them to understand like the nuances of digital analytics and metrics on a website and understanding those and being able to just follow the breadcrumbs of explaining why did numbers move, right? Like that's like level one. Mm-hmm. But then you very quickly start talking about layering in the business context and for that specific business. And I think that's why it takes 3 to 4 years to become a good consulting analyst, because you have to be able to step into these unique situations and say, yeah, I'm looking at your numbers move up and down, but I actually need to now realize, what do you as a stakeholder care about? What's the bigger organization care about? You know, what are some of the strategies you guys are actually deploying? And what does that mean then when I look at the numbers? And so I'd actually love to switch slightly and just ask you, how do you help them mature that business context piece? And I think too, like, how do you help them understand that not every e-com business is going to have the same focus, even though they're an e-com business and they have a, you know, purchase funnel?
Yeah. It's you're right. It's like kind of definitely the next step, and it's the harder step, I think. You know, that the first part, it's a little more tangible to kind of get them started. I think the one thing, Tim, when you're saying like wanting to hit a wall sometimes in the, like punch a wall in the beginning, is like, one, I have to reduce my expectations and slow down when I expect them to be good at that before I even get started onto the other part, because it's not going to be as fast as I think it is. And that's been like a huge learning curve. I hope my team forgives me. I know I can terrorize them sometimes. So like, it just takes some time. But that's one where I think it's like, as they've gotten a handle on some of that basic stuff, they're like, okay, I feel comfortable. I kind of understand the data I'm going to be working with, is starting to introduce like some business understanding, because that's not, once again, not something that you learn if you came out of a degree in analytics, which I think almost all of us did not get a degree in analytics and something else, because that wasn't a thing when we were in school. But they don't teach you about business necessarily. They don't teach you about marketing necessarily. So I start to layer in some training about that and start also bringing them into the conversations where they can watch the senior consultants do that work, and then ask them afterwards, like, what did you take away from that? And I'm always surprised at the answer. You know, sometimes they get something that I wasn't even trying to show, but I think that they don't get to really understand what that process looks like until they can watch someone else do it too. Cause it's like different. It's not, it's almost like, I think I've had some analysts be surprised how much, like in my role now, I don't do that much analysis and I just talk to people a lot because I need to understand all of that information. And then I do way less analysis and I just have it more focused, and then slowly give them practice doing that with like a safe stakeholder is what I do. So I like give them someone who I know will need them to be specific, but will be really forgiving if they get it wrong the first time. And so I like let them kind of free once I've kind of taught them the principle of that, and like let them get it wrong. It's kind of like the next step.
So the teaching them about, I mean, I tend to think, well, in the digital analytics side, there's business and business models. Like to me, that's part of the fun of consulting, is to go into an industry and have, you know, learn how pharma works, or learn how CPG works, or learn how retail works. And then there's marketing kind of specifically, which that seems like the other, everyone's exposed to marketing all the time. So how do they switch over to, and maybe UX or digital, whatever, those are all kind of the same, that you've been, yes, you think that you've seen banner ads and paid search and you've experienced websites and mobile apps, but you kind of need to shift around, and that's all good information. Congratulations, you've had the customer experience, but you need to shift around and think about the business's priorities and agenda. So like, how does that training happen? Like, I can't imagine that you're like, well, let's talk about an income statement, or let's talk about, you know, the four P's. I'm assuming it's like somehow more focused, that you're not trying to provide an entire business degree.
Yeah. I mean, it messy and chaotic is how we do it. I'm just kidding. Okay. I mean, I've always tried, because there's so many topics, like what you just covered right there. It's like within marketing just itself, it's like, how does banner advertising work? How does that tracking fire? What are the nuances of that? That's all, you know, yeah, right. It doesn't fire and it's terrible and no one should do display advertising. this is not sponsored by anti-display advertising people. But there's so much complexity there. And that's what I realized with the other senior consultant in my firm, is like, we know because there's been so much time that we built up of like all those little areas, I don't expect them to know everything that I know about digital advertising tracking or even about specific industries, right? So I start kind of targeted. So it's like, if someone's already in, if it's an analyst I'm training in-house for somebody, I'm going to focus on the industry that I know they're currently in and train them around there. And for the marketing, it's also like, I kind of train what I know is going to be most relevant for them at a specific time and try to keep it as surface level as possible for those areas. If they need to go really deep into one, we can go there or they can go there, because at this point, they're going to be able to go into the most updated information about that I don't have anymore because I'm not in it every single day. So it's not like a great answer, but it's like I see, okay, this person's going to really have to handle understanding organic search and like get a little bit specific into there. So I'll point them in that direction. This is where the curiosity comes in, because it's so much easier if someone's like, oh my God, I'm so interested in how that algorithm works. Like, I wonder what that is, and like gets excited about it. And like, that's kind of the beautiful thing about marketing analytics, is it really is complicated how all that works. But once again, easier if they're curious, because then they can just kind of dig in on their own. I can point them in the right direction and then they'll go after it.
Julie, do you, before we move off of that, you're the closest to being in that point with your little math degree, so you didn't know anything. like, if you think back to that, were there any helpful? I mean, there were lots of things that were not helpful, I'm assuming, but are there any like, oh, that was useful, it came from the company or somebody in the company, or even it was, I just decided to go do X or Y, that you felt like gave you like a leg up on some form of context? That's a hell of a question to throw at you.
Yeah, that is. I feel like it always stuck best for me in the context of a client problem or question, and in like the real world stuff I was trying to do and figure out. Like, I could go look things up on like basic marketing things, right? Or I could ask people that actually execute digital marketing for our clients, you know, specific things about strategy, and it would give me a basic sense. So I could go ask those kind of baseline, like get my footing of like, how do I even word what I'm asking? Or like, what are the bounds with what I'm working with? But I really do feel like for me, and I think what resonates with a lot of the training, Mary Beth, that you were talking about that you find helps younger analysts, was to actually see it when I'm faced with a real problem that like I'm on the hook to help solve, is when it really clicked for me. And to speak to the stakeholders and hear it from their mouth and be able to say back like, so what I'm hearing is this. Am I understanding that right? Like, you guys are trying to do this through these means and we're hitting a wall because we can't get X or Y data piece, blah, blah, blah. And I could also partner with, you know, the implementation specialist on the client team. So I would say for me, it was like living through it in the actual client problem was like the biggest breakthrough and what always made it really solid that I could then build on it in like my next experiences.
That to me makes the case, not the path I followed, but it does feel like if you're interested, like it's a case for getting into consulting or agency to start your career because of the breadth and the quick turn on the problems. Whereas if you go straight in house, you do wind up with kind of the specifics of that organization and their narrow focus, and you're probably a little more limited on who is going to be trying to coach you up. I guess I'm realizing that too, Mary, as you're talking about it, Mary Beth, you're saying we bring people in. We are in the business of delivering this service. We can invest in the training, the coaching. We know there will be a wide range of examples, which is really useful early in your career to start to get kind of mental models sort of worked. This is making me feel more like I made some poor career choices. Right. Cause like, you need to have that type of thinking that feels like a better baptism by fire, you know, pretty intense period to get that broader exposure. And then if you go in-house, you're like, great, I've got a pretty robust set of tools that I'm now going to tackle these problems. Not that I'm sounding way too prescriptive on something that I have no business prescribing.
I mean, I think I, coming from someone who did start my data career as a consultant, I think it did really, really help. I don't think it's, yeah, it's like, it's not going to say that's the only path. If you want to go the get further faster and really like challenge yourself, it's the right way to go, I think, or one of the right ways to go. Because yeah, you get to solve more problems faster and the expectation is to do it 5+ times faster than someone internally is going to do it. And so it's not for every, I also tell everyone consulting is not for everybody. It can be really demanding and not every consulting firm is going to be a very good place to work, I would also say. So you're going to, it could be demanding, but it can be a really good way to get a feel and also figure out what you like in data faster, because it's such a broad field and you get to touch more things, be like, ah, well, I don't really like that marketing analytics stuff, but I'm really interested in this thing over here. And yeah, it might take you a little longer on the internal route. The other thing I would say is finding a company that's more advanced in whatever you're looking for would be another good option if you wanted to be in-house. Because if you end up at like a company that's low in data maturity, that's really going to be a slog to learn these skills faster. And I think you'd be more at risk falling into that, I just am a reporting squirrel, which is not my term, but I'll talk about whose term it is at the end. But it's definitely something that, you know, finding that really forward-thinking company could be another way to do it.
I have a question about thinking of consultants and actually thinking of, because we've talked a lot about new analysts coming in and how to train them to be a good consulting analyst by being curious and listening to business context. But I have run into consultants before that, you know, have been in the industry a long time. And I almost wonder, did they start out curious and lost the curiosity because they saw things repeat over time? I don't know. But I run into this mindset, which I find very interesting and really, I think, harmful to like the end product that you can deliver your clients, where they kind of think, oh, I've seen this before, I know best. And they almost talk down to the clients as if they know their business better. And it drives me crazy because going back to your business context piece, every situation is unique, whether it's just the stakeholders, the vertical they work in, the way the organization is structured, or the industry and like the competitive market. I mean, there's just so many aspects. So it drives me crazy when they do that. And have you run into that? And how do you help combat like a mature consultant who's lost their curiosity?
Well, usually we just outcompete them. but yeah, I mean, I agree. I'll say my opinion definitely is aligned to yours that like, even if I have 10 years of experience solving that exact same problem, they're the experts in the business, not me. So it's not my job to tell them what to do. It's my job to give them the information in a way that a business person can decide on their own. And you know, when I, like, so far, I'll say for my firm, I've only hired really curious senior people or junior people I've trained. But I think when I interact with other consultants, because, you know, at big companies, there's always going to be more, I just stay firm in my perspective of being, you know, even if they go, well, this is what, you know, I've seen at other businesses and this is what you should do. Da, 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 da. I'm not going to be afraid to just be like, turn it back to the business owner or the executive and say, well, what's most important to you? And what have you seen work in your business? Because, you know, business owners have a lot more wisdom. And I think that that's another like pitfall of analysts, that we need to stay humble, even though we have a lot more depth of information into a specific area, we don't have that people value or like the really, really big picture. And we should be like providing what we can and like shortening that down so that they can use it. It's not that we shouldn't ever think that executives are stupid or anything like that.
So I think there are, I have a little tolerance for the career consultants who have decided, and that's partly because it's the group they're sitting with all day every day, is they start kind of thinking themselves. I mean, they're classic. I have yet to find a former McKinsey consultant that doesn't irritate the living shit out of me, because when they start dropping that they're a former McKinsey consultant, and that I have worked with organizations with McKinsey people, and I'm like, you're not all that in a, you know, box of chocolates. Like, get over yourself. You think you've drunk the Kool-Aid that was McKinsey 25 years ago. And I feel like that agency is the same way. I mean, I think that happens in lots of cases where they stop having the curiosity of saying, instead of bringing, hey, I've seen a lot of clients, does this apply to you or how does it not apply to you? Is way, way, that is productive. You just set me off.
All right. I want to kind of turn it a little bit, Mary Beth, and see what you think of this. Is it possible for someone to exhibit too much curiosity? Like, how have you seen it turned into maybe a weakness? And what do you do about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that there's like, it's almost like the academic type where there's someone who is just so absorbed into doodling around into like the small minutia of something that you just can't get them to be someone who's going to have that drive of a consultant or that drive to like hold on to a long-term internal project. And it's kind of a hard one because you don't want to kill the curiosity, right? Like you really want to use that. But I think that's where that kind of, you need to find a combination of someone who's not just curious for curiosity's sake and like finding out the answer, but is curious because they want to see impact. And so like what I have done in that, because I've definitely experienced some people like that, is to continue to like question that, like, well, what would be the business context or what could we do here? And like, what does that mean for the people we're working with? And try and imbue without bullying some urgency to what we're doing. But I definitely think that there's a few different types of curious person, and that like academic, I want to study mouse feet of the North American spicy mouse or something. Please cut that example out. It's been a long day. Okay.
I feel like it has to stay. Okay. I'm sorry.
Did you say spicy mouse?
I feel like that might be an actual example. You're like,
yeah. It really is. And if that's what they want to study,
spicy mouse
for the rest of their life, then
I like it.
Then you're not going to be a good like data analyst is what I'm saying.
Honestly, I love that example because that's precisely the kind of thing that would send me off to research what's a spicy mouse. And
it's not a real thing. So, it's made it up.
No, but I'm just saying like.
But I'm curious.
But there's a purpose for that question too, because I've been literally given that feedback in my career. That's like, you're asking too many questions and you're slowing down the process and you need to figure out a way to button it up a little bit better. And sometimes I'll like just be running 40 miles in the wrong direction with a cool thing I think is neat and then come back and it's sort of like, well, this doesn't have any bearing on what anybody's doing. So what are you doing? It's like, oh, well, and I feel like, you know, today in this world, that's where what data scientists do. No, I'm just kidding. Shots fired. Sorry. I'm bad. I know. Anyways, so. But it is a challenge to sort of find that balance, right? Because I think that innate curiosity, someone's really curious, aligning that with sort of like what needs to get done in the timelines and things like that can sometimes be a challenge.
I think, you know, one thing I'd like to add is one of the ways that we've, because it's almost like, I feel like it's been like an evolutionary arms race on training analysts at our company, because I'll be like, oh, I think I got it down. And then something like that will happen and be like, oh, how do I train people to not do that? My analyst listening to this hopefully will forgive me for all of that. One thing was to tie them into the project management process a little bit and just give them a bit more oversight, because I definitely had that sometimes. So I'd be like, because I'm someone who really just kind of like hands off. I'm like, be free, go be curious. And then they, you know, we'll go way down somewhere. And I was like, oops, but I didn't mean like that. So like having them think through a project plan and like show me what they're thinking of doing before they go down the rabbit hole has been really helpful, because then I can rein it in a little bit and say, what if we go this way instead? And check in more regularly has been a huge, this is like totally learning from my mistakes kind of thing, not like I got it right the first time, has been so valuable, because then it's like I can really help guide somebody of like, oh, what? Wait, well, this was the business question. What if we did this instead? And like, then let them go off and do their thing again. So it's just like a little bit more of a catch and release has been helpful.
Well, kind of down that same path then, I was going to ask, what are some structures to put in place to give people enough space with their curiosity? But to your point, keep them on track to the end goal, because there is the benefit of they asked one thing, but along the way they found something unexpected, but that is really valuable to the business and your end recommendations or findings. But exactly, like, you can't just go off in all the directions and explore them all and then come back a year later, you know? So what do you kind of help put in place? And I know you just started to describe some things, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a delicate balance of some resources, but having even very like entry-level analysts build their own project plans for what they're planning to do is super helpful, and have them put even hours to it. Because, you know, we're coming from the consulting world, but I've even had the people that I've been training in-house at companies do the same thing, because then it kind of gives them that scope. So what I do on the other side to balance it is to give them a pretty big bank of exploratory time in that first part. So it's like, okay, you're going to get in there and you're going to do an exploratory analysis where you get to doodle around for 6 hours and just really explore all of this, write down all of your ideas, and then you're going to come up with a thesis statement. So I almost kind of bring it back to like traditional science in that way. And then I still leave the door open during that process. If they get started on an analysis and there is something that's just like really relevant, it's not like the project plan is set in stone and it's what you have to follow no matter what, even if it's not working. It's just there as that start to get them to start to think about how long it takes to do certain things. Because it also helps me identify where they might be missing a competency. Because if they estimate that it's going to take them only a certain amount of time to do some data cleansing that I know is going to be really hard or something, I can be like, ask some more questions there to see where they maybe have a weakness. So that's kind of the way that we've found the balance of that. And it's not perfect, and it always goes a little wrong or sideways in some of the things, but it gives them that bound. And during those, you know, they check in, but then that rest of the time, they have a lot of freedom to be curious. And then if they feel stuck, they can come back to us and we'll like help prompt that next part.
But I mean, this does spark for me, like it's a lot cheaper and faster to write down, I wonder about, I could do this other thing. And I think back to having discussions around like, what's one of the benefits of using R or Python over staying within the analysis workspace or within Excel? And that is, you can make notes of like, I could look at this. I could pull in this other data source and compare it. And you can kind of ideate and think through the things you could explore. You could be curious about things that are really quick. What if I threw this other dimension on? Would it show anything? Throw it out, but mm-hmm. have the degree of judgment to say, you know, like, I wonder if this other economic indicator actually might be a confounding factor here. I don't have to go and get it and prove it. I can write it down. I can have my list, and then I could maybe sit down with someone else, whether they're more senior or just a sounding board, to say, hey, I've got some capacity to do some additional exploration. These were my ideas. Now roll that back into the project plan, or even talking to the stakeholder. Hey, I know you asked for X. I was kind of thinking I could look into this or this or this. All of these are going to take a couple hours each. I don't want to just, you know, burn your time and never give you a result, but what do you think? And kind of learn how even the stakeholder is probably curious. If the stakeholder says, oh yeah, there's an amazing, like, you could totally use this thing that the analyst doesn't even know they have. So I think that's another coaching by saying, you sit down and write down, like, what would you pursue if you do it where it's like, well, I just burned a day pulling one thing, then you're not going to learn that curiosity needs to be somewhat focused and disciplined.
That really like rang true to a few things I took out of that. Is like, one, I didn't think about this, but I always am trying to get the analysts to work within a platform and not just pull it with SQL or whatever, because I want them to explore a little bit more. And like, they're always like, oh, well, like, the platform is lame or whatever. I don't think that my analysts say that, maybe, but you know, and I'm like, here's why. And then you're right, that's something that I do, and I didn't really think about it, is like, I actually just like have a document open or whatever, and I just go, what about this? And I just like do my questions when I'm like doing that initial thing. So maybe that's something that needs to be a new training or process at our company, is to have them have that little thing. They're like, oh my God, another one.
But it's nice to have those ideas saved up too in a bank, because even mm-hmm. part of, like, specifically for consulting, you come to the end of a quarter, or suddenly your stakeholders like really love working with you, and they're like, so what else do you think we should do? And if you haven't put that time into thinking about it, I mean, through all the hours you work for them and you're building this context, and yeah, it's a great thing to have when you get that question of like, oh, I get the freedom to maybe say like, oh, we could do this or this. Like, it's nice to have that at your fingertips.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And you know, once you get, I think that also like once you get people starting to think that way, it's just like more natural and it just has a momentum to it, especially with the client when you start to get to know their data really well. So it's, yeah, getting them in the habit, like we just do a backlog too of like ideas. And I think once also they feel like they have the freedom to do that, kind of going back to like, what are people setting expectation wise, it starts to flow. And all of a sudden you're in this like critical period where you're having to decide which ones you want to do and like prioritize, which is like the good place to be in versus like having them be kind of like just reactive to whatever is being asked.
Awesome. All right. We do have to start to wrap up, even though this is a topic that all of us, I think, really love and obviously are pretty fond of. So, but very great conversation. One thing we like to do is go around and share a last call with our audience, something that might be of interest. Beth, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you'd like to share?
Yeah, I do. And I promise it's not AI, but I know others are. And it's actually an old article, but I wanted to do something related to our topic. And I made a few references to his work. Reporting squirrel is not my term, but I wanted to call out Avinash Kaushik as like an amazing resource on like how to be an amazing analyst. And I have a link that you'll put in the notes, I think, of like the biggest web analyst mistakes and how to avoid them. There's a few other articles that he has that are just like amazing, but that's one of the other things that I use a lot with my analysts is like working through a lot of his content and the way that he talks about it, because he's always blending together the stakeholder management part with other parts. So I just really recommend that him as a resource. He has like a premium newsletter that's like $100 a year. It goes to charity. Super recommend it. I'm not sponsored or anything. I just really love his work and reference it a lot. So that's mine.
Awesome. Thank you. Julie, what about you? What's your last call?
Well, mine's AI.
No shame in that.
There's no shame.
That's right. But I had a coworker recently send this to me, and I admittedly have not gotten a chance to actually fully test it out, but I'm excited to. It's called Scribe AI. It's a Chrome extension, and it is supposedly able to auto-generate a step-by-step guide of whatever you do. You just click record and it watches what you do, and it will take screenshots and annotate them and give you step-by-step and grab links. So I'm like really excited when this comes in handy. I learned about it a few weeks ago and surprisingly have not come across like a work use case where I really want to put it to the test, but I'm excited to try it and hopefully it comes in handy for somebody else.
Is your Chrome currently up to date, or are you due to?
No, okay. Of course not, Tim.
What color is the button?
Come on.
Is it yellow?
Yellow.
Is it red?
It's not red.
It's yellow.
No, it's yellow.
That's good.
All right, you two. Tim, while you're not policing Julie's Chrome update status,
get out of here.
Which also, I'm like team red update, so.
Thank you.
Yeah, you wait till it turns red. And then you update it. Jeez, Tim. When else would you do it?
Immediately.
And why don't you share a last call instead of answer that question? What's your last call?
So this is it's a musical last call. It was in the Measure Slack, but a guy named Josh Silverbauer is putting together. If you go to universalsunset.com, so the music is on YouTube as well as Spotify, but he is composing basically like a rock opera that's kind of triggered by the sunset of Universal Analytics. Jason Packer has actually gotten involved and is helping with him. So there's like a Pivot Pro song coming out. Shout out to our sponsors. I think there's an Adobe one, but it's actually the production values are, I mean, it's good. They are all like different themed. The musicians have chops. The production is high quality. It is like literally the sort of thing you could put on and just listen to in the background, but they are also having all sorts of like subversive fun with the project. What about you, Mr. Helbling?
Well, we kind of touched on some things related to sort of like business context, and that reminded me as we were looking at the episode of a book that I sometimes grab off of my shelf, which is, I'll hold it up for the camera, The Business Acumen Handbook by Stephen Haynes. So we'll provide a link to that. But that I've used this book more as a reference, not like something you read, but it's something you kind of dig into and be like, how do managers in the org think about these topics, or how do they approach these problems? It's a useful way for an analyst to sort of think in the mind of a business leader. So it sometimes can be a useful reference for kind of stepping into the shoes of your stakeholders a little bit and learning more about the context of the business that you're working in. So that's my last call.
Like, so how's it like, it's structured, like what are the chapters? So isn't it?
So it'll be like decision making, how that happens, the structure of that, how is an organization structured, how to think about process and how that is leveraged in an org, stuff like that. So yeah, it's just cool. Lots of different little kind of sort of probably like mini MBA type stuff. I don't know. I've never gotten an MBA, but that's what I use. All right. What a great episode. What a great show. Mary Beth, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us about this topic. Loved having you. And I personally have a lot of like, oh yeah, I struggle with that too, because I feel like maybe we're on similar journeys in terms of like the things we might be doing. But thank you so much.
Thank you. It was so fun. I think it was the most fun I've had on a podcast. So.
Well, we do. We try.
Well, it's a low bar.
I mean, I don't know.
That's true. Some of them are kind of dry.
You know, we'll work to make it boring here at the end. And no, I'm just kidding. So, but actually, speaking of not boring, no show would be complete without a huge shout out to our producer, Josh Crowhurst. I love you, Josh. Thank you for all that you do to help make the show happen. And if you're listening to this and you're curious about something we've said or you have something you'd like to share, I would love to hear from you. And there's great ways to do that. Probably the best ways are the Measure Slack chat group or on LinkedIn or Twitter. Mary Beth, are you active on social media?
LinkedIn is the place to go. You can also get me on the Measure Slack chat as well.
Awesome. Awesome. So there you go. So you can connect with Mary Beth that way as well. So great show, everybody.
And the world silently spinning is available on for your Kindle.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yes, that's true. I think it's only 99 cents.
Tim, you've read it.
I did. I enjoyed it.
I read the reviews, and someone was like, "I cried twice." I was like, "Ooh, this seems hard for me. I don't know."
You can wait to the second book. The second book is not as dark or sad. So if you want to wait a year.
Yeah. I was like, there must be a very different side of your personality, Mary Beth. You seem so like upbeat and positive.
There's just like, I've seen some stuff. Yeah. Read some stuff.
There's a lot of blood. There's a bear. There's broken bones.
Well, let's just say this, that I think both of my co-hosts, Julie and Tim, would agree with me that no matter if you've got too much curiosity or you're building up to get some more, just remember this. Keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. Let's keep the conversation going with your comments, suggestions, and questions on Twitter at Analytics Hour, on the web at analyticshour.io, our LinkedIn group, and the Measure Chat Slack group. Music for the podcast by Josh Crowhurst.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
I love Venn diagrams. It's just something about those three circles and the analysis about where there is the intersection, right?
Rock flag and spicy mice.